This is Writers on a New England Stage, a partnership between NHPR and the Music Hall in Portsmouth. Writers on a New England Stage brings acclaimed authors to the Granite State to discuss their lives and recent works. And in this episode, NHPR's Rick Ganley sits down with best-selling author Dan Brown to discuss his latest novel, The Secret of Secrets. The sixth novel in Brown's Robert Langdon series, The Secret of Secrets, is a thrilling race through the dual worlds of futuristic science and mystical lore, as Langdon uncovers a shocking truth about a secret project that will forever change the way we think about the human mind. This conversation was recorded before a live audience at the Music Hall in Portsmouth on September 10th, 2025.
I want to start by asking you, Dan, it's been about a decade since we've had a Langdon novel?
8 years.
8 years, so close to it.
Thanks for bringing that up.
You've been busy in between. You've had some other things going on. Why now?
Well, I finished it. That's why now. That's right. You know, 8 years is a long time. It was not for lack of effort. I decided I would write a book about human consciousness. It's no secret I like to write about big topics, bloodline of Jesus Christ, you know, antimatter, that sort of stuff.
Light reading.
That too.
Yeah.
And I, there really is no topic bigger than human consciousness. It is the lens through which we see ourselves, see reality, interact with each other. And it's also a very ethereal, ephemeral topic. And as it turned out, it was pretty tricky to figure out how to turn it into a fast-paced, urgent, relevant thriller. It just took a while to figure out how to do. I did figure it out, and here we are.
So you've had this idea for a while for the main theme of the book.
I have indeed.
But you've been spending the last several years obviously researching it. Can you tell us about some of the research you were doing, your method, experts you're talking to?
Sure. I mean, whenever I'm doing research, the first thing I do is I read everything I can on a topic. I have to understand human consciousness, in this case, to the point where I can at least have a conversation with a specialist or a physicist or a noetic scientist, a thanatologist, and understand even what they're talking about. So that's where I start. And then I start interviewing, in this case, a lot of physicists and noetic scientists, and also people who had a lot of out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences. And I should say that 8 years ago, I entered this project pretty skeptical. If you had asked me, do you believe in life after death, for example, I would have said absolutely not. When we die, it is a full stop. Your computer whose power cable has been cut, and it's just blackness. And 8 years later, I have come out the other side with a much different point of view on consciousness and death. And I should also add that that is not because I've had any sort of religious experience. I haven't had a near-death experience or out-of-body experience. This is based entirely on the science that is happening right now that is starting to percolate and that we're going to start hearing about in the next 5 years. Absolutely astonishing changes.
We should talk a little bit about the main theme of the book, and we should talk a little bit about Catherine Solomon being kind of that main character in the science that you're talking about here, the science of consciousness and human consciousness.
Sure. I wrote a book about 12 years ago called The Lost Symbol, and in that there was a character named Catherine Solomon who was a noetic scientist. She studied consciousness. She was kind of an ancillary character in that book. But as I was writing it, I thought, oh, human consciousness, and I what I learned about it was sort of so astonishing that I thought this is worthy of a whole book. And I thought my next book would be this one. But I couldn't figure out quite how to do it. And I actually wrote two books in the meantime, studying consciousness the whole time, trying to get to the point where I could figure out how to write a book about it. Catherine is in this book. And if you've read my books, you know that Robert Langdon is very lucky. In every book, he meets a beautiful, brilliant woman who happens to know exactly what he needs her to know. He's very, very fortunate in that way. And of course, you know, he's a university professor, and his luck is not so good in that he constantly falls into these horrible situations that no college professor should ever fall into.
But he does it in beautiful locales.
That is the good news.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I learned writing Deception Point never to set a book in the Arctic Circle or anywhere you don't want to go. So this book is set in Prague. And I wanted to do something different with Langdon this time. I wanted him to be very much in love rather than just meeting somebody. And that was tricky because I wanted the relationship to be solidified and meaningful. And yet I also wanted the romance of a new love. And the way I chose to do that was to go back to The Lost Symbol, where he met Catherine Solomon, And Catherine Solomon is a noetic scientist. She studies consciousness, and they've known each other. They've been colleagues for years. Always have circled each other romantically, but really never, their lives really never lined up. And this is the moment that after all these years, they finally line up.
And he's a bit skeptical of her field, isn't he?
He is, actually. And what's funny about Langdon is he's much like myself. He was skeptical of all things in noetic science. And she is a very much a believer in this new science. And over the course of the novel, he becomes more and more convinced by this woman who is his intellectual equal. And what's kind of fun about the novel is every time she says, Robert, here is this incredible experiment, let me tell you what happened, the reader, if you're anything like me, will say, that's absolutely impossible. And fortunately, Langdon is right there to go, Catherine, that's absolutely impossible. So you always have the skeptic sitting on your shoulder throughout the entire novel, really asking the questions that that most readers will have.
And your novels involve a lot of puzzles, obviously, a lot of ciphers and codes and symbols. You're inviting the reader to kind of solve along with the story, I think. You want them
sure. You know, we
give
all,
them clues here and there, but you don't want to give away anything at the end of a chapter.
We all love treasure hunts and codes. I mean,
yeah.
We all, you know, I'm sure half the people here do the Wordle or do crossword puzzles. We love that aha.
Got it in three today, three.
That's right. By the way, the Wordle yesterday was a word that I chose. It was sponsored by the Secret of Secrets. The word was glyph, G-L-Y-P-H. So I got a lot of complaints about that word.
That's you, huh? That's okay, right. Thanks.
That's right. Yeah, a lot of people missed the Wordle yesterday.
I got like 10
apologies.
Minutes every morning to get it done, you know?
You know, as my dad said, we grew up doing puzzles. My dad loved codes. We had treasure hunts for Christmas that led us to our presents. I've always thought that puzzles were a whole lot of fun, and I incorporate them in these books.
Now, for the first time, I believe you're taking us to Prague in this one.
This book is set almost entirely in Prague.
Yeah.
That's where Robert Langdon and Catherine Solomon wake up together in the very first scene. And it also includes a thread in New York City at Penguin Random House Publishers, which is my publisher. And I think, you know, wouldn't people who like books like to get a glimpse inside a publishing company? How are books purchased? How do they decide what to buy? How do they keep them safe? How do they edit them? How do they market them?
I was shocked to read the statistics in that chapter when it began. Random House putting out about 20,000 books a year.
Well, the CEO of Random House is here tonight, so you could ask her.
Okay, all right.
That's right. I don't know if those numbers are right, but they were fact checked by the Penguin Random House people.
Okay.
So, and also my editor Jason Kaufman is here tonight, who is a character in the book. I don't know where you are. I can't see anything. So, Jason, if you're there, stand up and wave.
That's right.
Yeah. So, Jason makes an appearance in all of my books as Jonas Kaufman, which, if anybody is even remotely skilled at anagrams, can probably figure out pretty quickly. And he always makes a little bit of a cameo. He showed up in Da Vinci Code as Robert Langdon's editor and always sort of has a chapter or two. And in this book, he's a full-blown character and offers a little bit of comedic relief on a really tough day. And what's funny about Langdon is about Kaufman, is he ends up in a really tough situation, but he's not too worried because he's edited so many thrillers. He knows how to get out of every situation. And what he finds is that none of it works. That's right. That these authors have all taken him down the wrong road.
I want to bring you back to Prague a little bit because it's really a character in the book, like all the settings in your books. Why Prague? What intrigues you about it? Tell us a little bit about how you, I imagine, travel the city and your process for, do you take notes where you're going? Do you take pictures? Do you write on the road while you're there?
Sure. You know, Prague, as soon as I knew I was writing about consciousness, I knew it had to be Prague. Since the 1500s, when Emperor Rudolf II brought all of the mystics and scryers and alchemists and kabbalists and seers, he brought them all to Prague to help him glean information from the great beyond, to help him run his empire. Prague has been the mystical capital of Europe. For those of you who've been there, you know that it has that reputation, not only historically, but in the present tense. And it's one of these places that, especially at night, you feel like the veil between reality and mysticism is very thin. And it has this sort of magical quality about it. It's the city of a thousand spires. I happen to think it's the most beautiful city on earth. And I like to use location as a character in these novels. And as a character, Prague is absolutely perfect for Langdon. It's full of secret passageways and crypts and cathedrals, and even has a door with seven locks, which seemed like I had to figure out how to use that somehow.
Absolutely, there's begs for it. So as you're going through the city, as you're kind of taking this in, are you taking pictures for later? Are you taking notes?
I actually take notes. I do take pictures, but I found that really I try to write a description of the place as I'm in it. Because eventually somebody's going to have to read this description and feel the place. You might take a picture and look at it a month later and not remember a smell or a sound or something that was really going to help evoke the space. So I do as much writing as possible in the space that I'm writing about. And oftentimes, writing or seeing these places will become very, very inspiring. I'll say, oh, I have to find a way to get Langdon to this place. That wasn't part of the plan. In Prague, there's a couple locations that were not in the original outline that when I stumbled across them, I thought I have to change the book such that he can get there. When I was writing Origin, I had actually, I was almost done with the book, and I went back for a third time to the Cathedral of Sagrada Familia in Barcelona. And on this third visit, I went to see the Tomb of Gaudí for a couple extra details, I stumbled across a stairwell in this cathedral, a very, very steep spiral staircase that was incredibly dangerous. And when I saw it, I thought, somebody has to die in this stairwell. And I actually changed the ending of the book and killed the villain earlier. If you haven't read the book, sorry, he dies in the stairwell. And so he died earlier just so I could use that piece of architecture. So that's the location often will govern the plot on some level.
I feel a little more worried sitting next to you, but I've talked to a lot of authors who do daydream a lot about how they're going to kill off characters. That seems to be a preoccupation of authors.
I never thought of that. You're kind of right, actually. Yeah. I think it's how we work out our issues.
Seems healthy.
That's right.
Yeah. Robert gets, he's a rock star of an academic, really. He's at the Four Seasons. He's got monogram slippers waiting for him. He's well known. He's got access to all these places in Prague. Do you know any academics like that? I don't.
Yeah, I do, actually.
Really?
Sure.
Okay. I'm in the wrong circles. I
just spoke to, I did a podcast yesterday in New York with astrophysicist Brian Green, who's one of the smartest guys on the planet, and I sat down and asked my publicist, who's also here, Todd, what am I doing here? Why I'm a writer. Why am I talking to a guy whose first question include the word quark? we actually had a fantastic conversation, but he's somebody who is an absolute rock star in his world.
I imagine this has been an interesting conversation, talking about human consciousness with him.
I'll listen to it. I'll tell you if it was interesting. I didn't understand much of it, but we talked for an hour and a half.
I want to go back a little bit, talking about Random House. We talked about that a minute ago, but also your publisher, by the way, and there's a lot of secrecy around big new titles, and I think you go into a little bit about that. So if you are intrigued about writing and the industry itself, there's some great kind of background in the novel about that. It's like a literal secret of secrets when you have a big title like this that you've just released. How do you keep a book like this under wraps until you're ready to publish?
It's pretty tricky because my editor Jason and I are, for the last 8 years, and again, thank you for bringing up that delay. For the last 8 years, we've been, we trade pages almost daily, and we have to do it in a way that that nobody can find the pages, and we have a system for that has worked, and we kept the book secret for eight years. When it's just two people, that's one thing. But at some point, you're translating the book into 56 languages, or you're handing it out to reviewers. And this book went out on a platform called Digify, which is an encrypted platform and with non-disclosure agreements. And I'm amazed and very happy to say that we kept it secret until yesterday.
That's not an easy task with a big title.
It is not an easy task.
Yeah.
And I should say that is a tribute to my publisher.
I will say I got a copy of the book a couple of weeks ago, and I had to sign a non-disclosure agreement, of course. And every time I'd have the book with me in the car, and I get out of the car, I think, I better take this with me. You just, We don't want to take chances on this.
Did they send you a hard copy?
It was a
digital copy.
No, it was a hard copy.
Right, well, you're a VIP then. That's amazing.
Do you want it back or?
No, it's all yours.
I didn't leave it
in
the car.
I hope I never see the book again.
We have some audience questions here, and I want to get work these in. I thought this is interesting. Somebody's asking, you put so much into your covers with secrets and clues and hints. Do you have a final say on them? And how do you choose? How do you design them?
That's just some on the cover art.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. Covers are just such a tricky thing, and they're such a matter of taste. And all the countries around the world have different covers that work for their cover, mm-hmm. work for their audience. Here, the publisher and Jason and I went through many, many covers trying to find the right feel. And because the title implies something is very secret, we decided we did not want to give a lot of information on the cover. And the designers at Penguin Random House came up with just what I think is a spectacularly beautiful cover. And what's really impressive about this book, and I don't know if they're in your hands yet, I can't see you, but it's very, very heavy. And that is, you've all noticed, it's a heavy book. It is a beautiful book. The paper is a new kind of paper that bulks, that is a publishing verb. It bulks very well, meaning you can put a whole lot of pages in a very narrow area. They're thin pages, but they feel very luxurious. This book is quite long compared to the Da Vinci Code. The Da Vinci Code was 135,000 words. This is closer to 200,000, and yet it's the same thickness. The font size and the layout is identical. It is all because of the paper. And so you've got this beautiful book with this matte cover. I didn't have a lot to do with it. There was a whole lot of really good artists and book designers, so I'm just thrilled with how it came out.
Is that really important to you, though, as the author, to have that good book feel?
I think so. I mean, I grew up reading hardcover books, and I know, I've got nephews who read they'll read a digital book or a hardcover. It's all the same to them. To me, it's not, and maybe to some people in the audience, they prefer a hardcover. I love the feel of a book, and I was just so thrilled to feel this jacket, and even the pages. It's a very luxurious feeling book. It's really beautiful.
I much prefer to read a hard copy. Yeah. It is a 700 pages or so, I think. It's a good size read, but it's a thriller and it moves. How do you keep that pacing in a thriller like that and that kind of length, but also allow the reader to breathe when you need them to?
Yeah, that's a lot of that comes from having studied music. To be honest with you, music and writing music, composing music and writing fiction, in my mind, are very similar. You have to understand structure. You can't write a symphony or a song, and you can't write a novel without understanding structure. And the other thing is dynamic. You can't have three car chases in a row and three triple forte sections in a row. You need those moments in a song or in a novel to breathe. And if you're an artist, you know about negative space. You need the space in which to create whatever the art is that you're doing. I think it's very, very important for the reader to be breathless and then have a moment to exhale. And there are moments just like that in this novel.
Do you listen to music when you're writing?
I listen to nothing when I'm writing. I think maybe because I've studied music and love music so much, really my ear instantly goes to a melody, and I find it much more interesting than what I'm writing. So I've listened to white noise if it's noisy where I'm writing, but I do not listen to music.
You're listening to a conversation between NHPR's Rick Ganley and Dan Brown, author of The Secret of Secrets. Coming up, Brown discusses what his hopes are for all of his novels. We'll be right back in a moment with more Writers on a New England Stage from New Hampshire Public Radio. Welcome back to Writers on a New England Stage. This conversation between author Dan Brown and Rick Ganley was recorded on September 10th, 2025, in front of a live audience at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
Let's get to some more audience questions here. Someone's asking, who were your early influences and who influences you now?
Dr. Seuss influences me now.
Canon, yeah.
You know what? We grew up reading, Dr. Seuss, Richard Scarry, and then I got into the Hardy Boys. And, this, I mean, just so great. I remember being so upset when I learned that Franklin W. Dixon, the author of The Hardy Boys, was the same person who wrote the girls series. What was her name? Nancy Drew. They were both pseudonyms of the same guy. I was just so disappointed. But you know what? I think on some level, reading all the classics in prep school and college was certainly informative of the power of fiction. I always was amazed by Shakespeare's ability to have fun with words. And that certainly influenced me. Joseph Campbell, The Hero of a Thousand Faces, The Power of Myth, was very, very influential. Both of those. Yeah.
Any book you could think about that you wish you wrote?
Wow. Harry Potter?
I think you did okay with what you've done, you know. Here's a good one. Do you hope your novels have an impact beyond entertainment and thrills?
Sure. I mean, it's funny. I never imagined The Da Vinci Code would be controversial and create a dialogue. I mean, maybe that's naive, but I really did not expect it. That was a surprise to me. I've already heard that this novel is creating a little bit of a stir between materialist scientists and noetic scientists. But that is my hope, that to create a dialogue and that we can end up talking about these important topics, things like human consciousness and the big question, you know, what happens when we die? And, 8 years ago, as I was starting this novel, my mother passed away. And I remember really finding it impossible to believe that all of her hopes and fears and memories just disappeared in an instant. It's what I believed. There has never been a religion that has survived that has not promised life after death. So I could come to you and say, Rick, I've got the greatest religion. I describe the whole thing to you, and you say, I'm in. I say, one caveat. When you die, it's over. You say, you know what? I'm good. That's right. The fear of death is the great unifying fear that we all have. I don't care what language you speak or where you are. We all fear that moment that it's all over. And we long to know that there's something else. And to have spent 8 years sort of in that space of talking to people who believe there's something else and finding out that there's a whole lot of hard science suggesting that human consciousness may indeed survive the death of the physical body, it's just been a fascinating journey and very optimistic.
And you talk to people who have had these experiences, and you talk to experts, medical experts in the field that have studied this?
Absolutely. It's absolutely amazing that there are literally thousands and thousands of medically documented accounts of someone who dies on an operating table. They are resuscitated 10 or 15 minutes later, and they come back and say, no, I saw the whole thing. I was floating above my body. And the doctor says, no, you were imagining it. Your eyes were taped shut. You couldn't see anything. And the person says, no, the guy with the green shirt came in with that machine, and then you did this. This is what you said. And these doctors say, listen, we don't know how this happens, but it happens. And it's documented over and over. That's what we call an anomaly. And there are plenty of others. There's something called sudden savant syndrome that I talk about in the book. A kid in Arizona gets hit in the head with a baseball, knocked out, wakes up speaking fluent Mandarin Chinese. Okay, it happens. It is documented. Somebody gets in a car accident who's never seen a violin, and they wake up a virtuoso violinist. I don't care how hard you get hit in the head with a baseball. It does not carry all of Mandarin Chinese. So these are the sorts of things that in consciousness theory are known as anomalies. And I should just say that the current theory of consciousness is called local consciousness. And what it says is that all of our thoughts, our dreams, our hopes are the product of chemical processes in the brain. That your brain creates consciousness. And this is how we imagine it. It makes sense to us. It's how it feels. But these anomalies imply that may not be happening. And it's kind of like the geocentric model of the solar system. There was a time when we really believed the Earth was the center of the solar system. It's how it felt to us. But there were anomalies. There were stars out of place. There were planets rising at the wrong time. And Copernicus said, our model is wrong. Let's put the sun at the center. We need a new model. And suddenly all the anomalies disappeared. That's the moment in history where we are right now with human consciousness. These anomalies are adding up, and we're saying maybe our brain doesn't create consciousness. Maybe something else is happening. And there's a whole lot of science, really, really exciting science, to suggest that reality is much stranger than we think.
And there's an element of precognition in this book as well, talking about kind of seeing events before they happen. I don't want to give away too much, but that there's a lot to that. I don't know if you could talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Well, I mean, precognition is sort of another one of these anomalies, saying, well, it's impossible. And there's an experiment that's described in the book where, and this has been replicated, a scientist hooks you up to a brain monitor, and your brain will light up in different places depending on what image you see on a computer screen. They'll show you an image. And the images are divided into three categories. They are bucolic, peaceful images, a very violent image, and a highly sexualized image. And these three types of images light up in different places in your brain. So the computer will show them to you randomly, and of course, you can follow your brain lighting up. The problem is, your brain lights up before the image is shown. You say, that's impossible. Langdon says that's impossible. Catherine describes why it is not impossible. And furthermore, it turns out that your brain lights up before the computer has randomly decided what to show you. So I read about this experiment. I say, well, somebody's wrong. This makes no sense. So I get on the phone with a physicist who is involved in this. He said, well, it either implies that your brain is creating consciousness, or that your brain is receiving consciousness, or that time flows in two directions. And I said, I'm going to need a drink if we can. That's right. I don't think I can have this conversation sober.
This is why the book is 700 pages long.
That's right.
Yeah, there's a lot to unlock there. So you talk to experts in the field, too, that were also skeptics like yourself?
Sure. And Brian Greene is one of them.
Yeah.
It's absolutely fascinating because one of the things that I found when Da Vinci Code came out was that if you have dedicated your life to one mindset, one view of religion, and somebody comes along and says, actually, that's wrong, even in a novel, you get pretty defensive. That is what's happening right now in science. There's a battle between the materialist scientists who say, no, your brain creates consciousness. When you die, it's over, full stop. And you've got a whole lot of other people who are hardcore scientists who are saying, yeah, but describe this or explain this. This book is going to come out and say, hey, look, there may be another way to do it. And I'm sure that there will be materialist scientists who have dedicated their whole life to this view of local consciousness who are going to push back. Not really against me, but just against the notion. And there's going to be a fascinating dialogue that's already starting.
Changing gears. Nadia's member asks, what do you think of first, a character, a setting, or a plot? What's that kernel?
The plot. Actually, I think of, Jason and I are always talking about, what's the big idea? Every one of these books has a big idea. And the question is, what is it? Ideally, it's an idea where you can argue both sides of an equation. My first novel, Digital Fortress, was about national security and civilian privacy. And there's a huge gray area in the middle. You can argue, wow, the government really shouldn't be reading our emails. And the government can say, yeah, but if we don't, we've got terrorist attacks on U.S. soil. And you say, you're both right. That makes for a really fertile ground. So that's what comes first, this notion of what's the big idea? How much national security will you, how much civilian privacy will you give up to have national security, for example, in the first book? So all of these books start with that big idea. And then I think, what is the location in which this absolutely has to take place? In this case, it was in Prague. I wrote a book about the symbolism of Washington, D.C. Of course, it had to be set in D.C. The Barcelona Supercomputing Center was a place that was at the forefront of AI. Mm-hmm. That's why I set Origin there. I had an absolutely fascinating experience with somebody about AI there, where I naively said to him, I said, hey, I don't understand why AI is dangerous. Can't you just write a line of code in every program that says, whatever you do, it has to be in the benefit of humankind? And this man kind of laughed and almost patted me on the head and said, okay, let's do that. The first thing the computer's gonna do is say, okay, I've taken a look at natural resources. You have 9 billion people, you can only support 4 billion people, let me take care of that for you. And I realized, there's some gray area in that topic too.
Yeah, what do you think? You wrote about AI years and years ago now. What do you think about the subject now?
Of AI?
Yeah.
Well, the amazing thing about technology, two things are amazing. One is that every piece of technology that's created is a tool to create more technology. So you get this hall of mirrors effect where you get this exponential growth. 2 years ago, nobody had even heard of ChatGPT. Okay. A year from now, we will have things that we haven't heard of today that will be just ubiquitous. The other amazing thing about technology is that the human species has never created a technology that we have not weaponized. Whether it's fire, the wheel, the computer, we have always found ways to use weapons for evil. And so it's naive to think that things like consciousness research or AI will not be used for bad purposes. And yet, I think it's also important to remember that evolutionarily, the human species has been trained to stay alive by looking at what is dangerous. If you're out in a field that's beautiful and there's a lot to look at, but there's a lion sitting over there watching, you're pretty focused on the lion. That's why we focus on the news. That's why with the news is just full of horrors, because that's the stuff that we're trained to look at. But statistically, there is so much more love in the world than hate, so much more creativity than destruction, that we're getting a really warped perception of this world. And I will just say that, Tim, it's actually a pretty amazing place that we live in. And it was interesting just over the last day being on a lot of news programs, and you sit in the green room and you're gonna go out and talk about your little novel, and you're watching what they're talking about on either side of you, and it's horrible. And it's astonishing what we consume in the way of the horrors of the world. And it's important to understand that we're all very, very blessed, and that there are people in this world who are really, really struggling. I think it's also important to know that there is so much more good than bad and so much more love than hate.
Yeah, well said. I think what you're saying is you're an optimist.
I'm absolutely an optimist, yeah. I've been very, very fortunate in life, and I've experienced love and compassion from many, many people. And I've been beat up too, and not just by critics, you take the good with the bad, but I think it's really, really important to process the good in the same way that you process the bad. And just look at it as a whole.
Do you bother with the critics?
You know what? I'll just say this. Any writer who said that they don't care what the critics say, I think they're lying. I mean, I hate it when critics hate my stuff. it hurts. You wish that everybody loved what you do. But what I've learned is that when you're a creative person, all you have to guide yourself is your taste. Whether you're a writer, a musician, a chef, you write the book you want to read, you create the piece of music you want to listen to, the cake you want to eat, and then you just hope people share your taste. The people who share your taste are your fans, the people who don't are your critics, and life goes on.
Well said as well.
Thanks for joining us today for a conversation between Dan Brown and Rick Ganley. Coming up, Dan takes questions from the audience. We'll be right back. You're listening to Writers on a New England Stage from NHPR. Welcome back, and thank you again for listening to Writers on a New England Stage. We're hearing today from NHPR's Rick Ganley and author Dan Brown. Just ahead, a conversation about the importance of his longtime editor. This conversation was recorded in front of a live audience in September 2025.
What's the process look like when you're adapting a novel for the screen?
Yeah, it was so fun working with Tom Hanks and Ron Howard on these three movies. We had so much fun.
Who are they now?
Ron's a director. He did something called The Grinch. That's his big movie. Tom was a cowboy in some cartoon. They're nice guys. It was such an honor and a luxury to have my first experience in Hollywood be with the best of the best. I learned a lot in the process. We had a whole lot of fun. I will never forget the night that my first night of filming was at the Louvre after hours. And I'm standing there with Rita Wilson, Tom's wife, and I'm just sort of, looking at the Mona Lisa there, And she said, "Dan, just so you know, this is not how people's movie careers start. You're usually on a set in the desert where there's some giant worm eating somebody in a bikini. This is really a pretty nice entry into the film business."
Yeah, that's surreal, huh? What was it like to hand your work over, though, to a screenwriter, for instance? I mean, are you a hands-off author when it comes to that?
Yeah, or? It's like sending your kid off to college. You hope when he comes back, you recognize him. What was really, really interesting about making these movies, two things. One is you're trying to compress very complicated long stories into 2 hours, and it all falls away. So much of it falls away. And so when Da Vinci Code was in its first cut, which was 3 hours and 45 minutes, super secret, somebody flew out to Rye Beach with literally a briefcase. I don't think it was handcuffed to their hand, but it sort of felt that way, with their own DVD player and a DVD. They didn't want me to put it in my machine, didn't want anybody to tape it, so they hooked it up, and they played it, 3 hours and 45 minutes, and I felt like, where'd the book go? It felt like 1% of the novel. And so Ron called and said, what do you think? I said, you know, where's the book? He goes, you wait till we get this down to 2.5 hours. And I actually had, I had spoken lines in that movie that ended up on the cutting room floor. You know, I tell myself it's because of time. I'm sure it was pretty bad. I don't know how much money they wasted filming that. Maybe it was to humor the author so I'd be more pliable. But I don't know. It was a great experience.
Do you think you would make a good screenwriter?
You know, I would say no. And here's the reason why. I've always, you know, it's funny, you talk to a screenwriter and they say, well, I'm not a real writer, I'm not a novelist. Having tried to write screenplays, and I've written some screenplays, none of which you've ever seen, I wonder why. What you find out is that novelists luxuriate in an enormous palette of colors and tools that we can use to write novels. We can have multiple points of view. In a movie, you've got the camera, that's your point of view. I can jump in people's heads and tell you what they're thinking. I can mount a flashback just by saying Langdon recalled and just do it without having to go to sepia tone and interrupt the whole narrative. I'm fascinated by the process of screenwriting. And internal monologue is a big part of the way I write. You get to hear Langdon's thoughts and all the characters' thoughts. And you find out if Langdon's hungry, in a novel, he just has a passing thought that he's hungry. In a movie, he either has to say out loud, geez, I'm hungry. Or he has to sort of stare longingly at a bagel or you know what. You have to show it somehow. And you have to be incredibly efficient as a screenwriter. It's very hard.
I can imagine. And I imagine the process, too, can be kind of heartbreaking at times, and you have to kind of let some of those things you absolutely love about the book fall by the wayside.
Yeah, there were a lot, especially my scene. It was really good. Wait, I just have to tell you what happened on set at my scene. So we're in the opening of Da Vinci Code, and you'll see me. I'm in the scene, but I'm in the back, and you can't hear me talking. They took my mic away. But so we have this spoken scene, and Charlie Rose and I, of all people, he was on set just because he was friends with Ron Howard, and he said, "We're gonna put you guys in the scene, and you're gonna have this conversation."
So Rose, the talk show host.
Charlie, yes. Okay. Charlie Rose and I were going to talk about Robert Langdon, and Charlie Rose was going to say something like, "Wow, that was fascinating," and I was going to say like, "Yeah, I don't know." We're walking to set, and this is before cell phones. Charlie had the first BlackBerry, and he's walking along. We're all in full makeup, and he's checking his email, and he runs into a piece of scaffolding. Hit him right here, almost knocked him out. So now the clock is ticking. He's pretty loopy. They're fixing his makeup. He's bleeding, so they fix him up. And we go and we shoot this scene, but he is just, he can't remember his lines. He's pretty dopey from getting hit, actually. I wasn't much better, and I was fine.
Well, it wasn't you then. It was Charlie that ruined the scene.
Well, that's what I've always told myself. It was Charlie's fault. I never saw the scene. They never let me see it, and that's probably just so I can, yeah.
Someone asks, you've also written a couple of standalone novels, of course. What makes an idea good for one, but not the other, for your series with Robert Langdon?
Well, you know, what's funny is I wrote Digital Fortress. It was the first novel I'd attempted, and I will never forget. I had wanted to be a musician and went out to Los Angeles. Actually, got a record deal, made a record. It came out. Nobody bought it. My mom bought a copy, I think. That's right. But then I had an idea for a novel. I wrote Digital Fortress, and the first publisher who read it bought it. A guy named Tom Dunn at St. Martin's Press. They paid me $10,000 for this novel, and I thought I just couldn't. I was so happy. The novel came out and nobody bought it. I thought, oh, okay, so this is a little harder than it looks. After that, I wrote Angels and Demons. I just had an idea for this character named Robert Langdon. And after I finished that book, it didn't occur to me to bring Langdon back. I'd really enjoyed writing him, but it was a lot of art, a lot of history, and I wanted to write something clean and technical. And I wrote a book called Deception Point, which, by the way, we are now making into a movie with the guys who made Oppenheimer. So that's going to be a lot of fun. Yeah. And so when I finished Deception Point, I kind of missed Langdon. And I thought, well, I remember talking to Jason about it. Let's bring Langdon back. And that's what we did. And I haven't written a standalone since. Not because I don't want to, just because my publisher won't let me. Just kidding, Maya. I know you'd let me.
So are there plans to do more with Robert?
Of course. Yeah, I've got a whole lot of... At the moment, I'm kind of tired. And I'm about to head off on a pretty long book tour. But when I get back, I will probably, you know, take a breath and then figure out what's next. And I've got a lot of ideas for Langdon.
Do you get really tired of people like me asking you while you're on tour for one book, asking you when you're going to start the next?
Well, do you have children?
I do.
Okay. I want you to imagine this. You're in the delivery room. Your wife has just given birth. She's holding her newborn. Mm-hmm. And you look down into her eyes and say, honey, when are we doing this again?
Very good. Let's mark that down for the line of the night on the recording, please. Point taken. I hear someone ask, do you ever get sick of a topic before you even finished publishing it?
About 3 years into this novel, I had some feelings like that. You know what? I have chosen, I know these novels take a long time to write and they require a whole lot of research, so I choose topics that I personally find fascinating. And the great thing about consciousness research, especially because this book took so long, is that it is constantly evolving. It's all happening very fast. And the world of consciousness looks different today than it did when I began this book. And so there's constantly new information. And it was kind of interesting when I finished this book, you know, there's a little bit of a lag when you finish a book because you've got to edit it and fact check it and come up with covers and translate and do all of these things. And I'm constantly watching the news saying, please don't anybody, you know, don't come out with that great precognition experiment yet. I want it to be, you know, in the book. So.
Yeah, the state of the art is always moving so quickly nowadays. When the process of a novel is years taking, that's an interesting point. I never thought of that. By the time you get to the end of it, the state of the art may have moved.
Sure. I mean, and sometimes you'll learn something brand new halfway through a novel and say, wow, I need to rewind and change the plot a little bit to make sure that I can incorporate this information, not only because it's interesting, but to make the book accurate and timely.
So you've been a musician, obviously a writer, dabbled in film. What creative outlet would you like to try your hand at next? Anything different?
I'd love to learn how to cook, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think what's going to happen is I'm going to make a TV show with Netflix. This book, The Secret of Secrets, was picked up by Netflix. And this is going to be especially fun because, as I said, one of the challenges we had making these movies is these books are quite involved, and to make them into a two-hour movie is a challenge. The Netflix series will be an eight-hour movie. It will be eight one-hour series. And it is being spearheaded by the great Carlton Cuse, who's a terrific guy. He did a little show called Lost, which did all right. He did Jack Ryan and a bunch of other very popular shows. And it's perfect because Langdon teaches at Harvard, and Carlton conveniently went to Harvard. So they have that in common. He's a terrific guy. They have a great writer's room. And I've now read the first three episodes. And I got to tell you, it's really, really good. We're filming in Prague next year. I don't know who Langdon is yet, but I will let you know when I know.
That's exciting. Breaking news right there. An audience member asks, what advice do you have for young writers in a world of AI and the lack of arts funding?
You know, this is a fascinating time and an exciting time for young writers. When I started writing, the only way you could get distribution was to get a publishing deal, to convince a publisher that they should spend a whole lot of money editing your book, printing your book, distributing your book, marketing your book. Now every writer has an international publishing deal through ebooks right on your computer or through print on demand. And so what I tell young writers is, when you've written something that you feel is ready to be published, publish it. Self-publish your book. That's not to say don't try to go get a publishing deal, but while you're waiting to get a publishing deal, people can be enjoying your work.
Let me ask you how important it is, though, to have an editor. You've had a longtime editor you trust implicitly. How important is it for that first-time writer to have someone really help them with their work, go through it?
I think it's exceptionally important. And the reason really is that when you're writing a novel, the first thing you lose is perspective. You're working on it over and over and over, and you really, no matter how hard you try, you can't have that experience of what the reader feels the first time reading it. You know what the next word is. You try to ignore that and say, what would a reader think reading this? The editor is the person who can step in and read it as though it's the first time they've read it. Jason, you know, don't give him a microphone, please, because he'll stand up and say, look, I read this book so many times, I lost perspective too. So that's pretty important. The great thing about my relationship with Jason, we've been working together 28 years, something, I'm not sure, but we've done a lot of books together. What I do in these books, I do very intentionally, very specifically, and he understands what I'm trying to do. And it's really, I feel very fortunate. Not only do I get to do what I love to do, but I get to do it with my best friend. And I'm stealing your line from last night in New York, Jason, wherever you are. That's how I feel as well. So thank you for all the hard work. And you know, this book is dedicated to Jason. And it just says, you know, it would be almost impossible to write this book without him, but it most certainly would have been a whole lot less fun. We have a lot of fun doing this.
Yeah, here's to the editors and producers, yeah. I don't want you to betray any confidences, but are there any arguments between you and Jason? Are there notes tense notes back and forth?
Oh, never about the writing. It's usually about what we're ordering for dinner, you know, that sort of thing. You know what? I mean, no, never, ever tense. Ego goes out the window when you're trying to be creative. And as these guys behind me will tell you, you know, they've been creative for a long, long time. And the idea is to serve the music. In Jason's case, the idea is to serve the story. And whether the idea is mine or his is irrelevant. And if he comes along, you know, I have to tell them that this novel for 3 or 4 years had an entire thread with a character named, where are you?
Swedenborg.
And and we'd put a lot of work into this character, Swedenborg, and he was fascinating. And we eventually realized he's just not pulling his weight. and he's got to go. And it was a painful day. You know, we sort of burned some pages, you know, and raised a glass to Swedenborg. But those are the sorts of things that it's great to go through with first of all, somebody who can dull the pain, but somebody who can bounce the idea off of and feel like you're not making it in a vacuum.
We have just a few more minutes. I want to get a couple of quick audience questions in before we do go. If you had to choose a job not involved in the arts, not a writer, what would you choose to be? Stumped him.
I would absolutely be a teacher, but I kind of consider that the arts. It is the greatest art form on earth. It's the most important job on earth to the teachers in the audience. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And you'll be amused to know that when Sony Pictures bought the Da Vinci Code to make a movie, there was a document between us that said, Langdon is a professor. He solves problems with his mind, not with violence. He can never learn how to shoot a gun. He can't learn jiu-jitsu or karate. And it was a legal document that said, you can't change this character. And as my dad said, I grew up on the campus of Phillips Exeter. All the adults around me were teachers. My heroes were teachers. And so when it came time to write a hero, it was a professor. And I will feel that way forever, that the teaching is the most noble of all the professions.
I think that's a great way to go out, don't you?
You tell me.
Oh, right, I guess I have to run this thing. Okay. Dan Brown, I can't express my gratitude to you enough. Thank you so much for spending the time with us this evening on stage. I hope all of you have a great time reading the book. I think you will.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Writers on a New England Stage, a partnership between the Music Hall in Portsmouth and NHPR. Our host for the evening was Rick Ganley. The Music Hall's executive director is Tina Sautel. NHPR's president and CEO is Jim Schachter. NHPR's producer for Writers on a New England Stage is Sarah Plord. NHPR's program director is Emily Quirk. NHPR's production manager is me, Dan Cahill. The Music Hall's production manager is Jonna Morris. Music Hall live sound and recording engineer is Ian Martin. Musical director and band is Bob Lord and Dreadnought. And the Music Hall literary producer is Brittany Wasson. If you missed any part of this show, go to nhpr.org/books and download the Writers on a New England Stage podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. This is NHPR.